Phil Mason Show. Phil Mason Show is on. Is on in five. In five. Four. Four. Three. Three. Two. Two. One. One.
Welcome to the Phil Mason Show. I'm happy to have you here. We'll be here for the entire hour. We're going to mix it up a little bit. We're going to talk a little NBA basketball. Well, actually, we're going to talk a lot of NBA basketball. We got the Heat guys coming in. We have the Thunder guys coming in. And we're also going to talk a little Major League Baseball. Alex Hall from Athletics Nation will be here. But up first, Matt Moore from CBS Sports has written a monster blog post where he ranks all the coaches in the NBA. We're going to talk a lot about that today. And joining me up first to talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder and how Scott Brooks fared in that article, please welcome from WelcomeToLoudCity.com, J.A. Sherman is in the house. J.A., how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Phil. It's good to be back and get a chance to talk a little bit about Thunder and Scott Brooks. And I'm sure this will be a very divisive topic because he's a divisive kind of coach.
Well, absolutely he is. And I have my own opinions of him, as you know, and I've never shied away from that. Matt Moore has ranked him. Now, this is the subtitle of in this area of the, like I said, it's a monster post.
Yeah.
He says, the high expectations crew. And I'm gonna read it just to set this up. And I'll leave a link to this article, this blog post or whatever it is, in the show notes so you folks can check it out. These coaches represent the middle rung and are all, for the most part, good coaches with established reasons why they should win. Some are dealing with expectations of building off a high mark year. Some are dealing with title pressure. And some jobs simply come with seats pre-warmed. These coaches are further away from being fired than some of their peers, but these are also coaches whose seats could get red hot if no injury disaster befalls them. In this category, J.A., they have Scott Brooks tied for 10th. They have Dwayne Casey at 13, Lionel Hollins at 14, Dave Yeager at 15, Randy Whitman at 16, Byron Scott at 16. That section of coaches, does it seem strange to you that they would place up Scott Brooks alongside of, say, someone like Dave Yeager?
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of interesting because Matt Moore, the author, even prefaces his analysis of Scott Brooks by basically saying they chickened out on it. In his first comment, he says that Brooks should honestly be in the top tier because of what he's done. He's taken his team to the top two seed every year since 2011. He's made three Western Conference finals. He's gotten to the finals. And he's had to endure some pretty significant injuries to his teammates or to his team, excuse me. But then he sticks him in number 10 with a rating of 6.5 out of 10. And while I certainly wouldn't argue that he should be amongst Greg Popovich, Rick Carlisle, and Doc Rivers, I think to put him below some of the other guys is a little suspect. And then to group him sort of in the middle of the pack, it does feel like you're playing to the fans a little bit here, just because it's like, you know, we know Brooks is better than everybody thinks, but if we put him too high, everybody's just gonna kind of freak out. So they kind of chickened out on that.
Yeah, they seem to. Now, the guys that were ranked above him in the hot commodities section, this is kind of strange. Steve Clifford is tied for 6th. Jeff Hornacek. Now, these two guys have not made the playoffs yet, have they?
No, and this is not to say that they're not good coaches.
Here, the Hornets, nor that, excuse me, but
yeah, and nor that they won't be good in the future. But this obviously the playing in the West, it's going to be tough. But they're not there yet, and so to rank them basically on their potential to get there ahead of a proven track record is a little curious. And then you've also got Frank Vogel, who I actually really like, and everything I've heard about him behind the scenes tells me that he's a quality guy. He's ranked ahead of Scott Brooks, even though he just oversaw one of the biggest meltdowns for a number one seed in recent memory with the Indiana Pacers. And then you got a guy who's been unemployed for the past couple of years, and Stan Van Gundy. And who knows what he's going to do. He just tried to put his entire handprint on the Pistons, and we don't know if that's going to work yet or not. So to put all those guys ahead of Brooks, to me, is a little suspect. I mean, you couldn't bump him up again ahead of those guys. To me, that's a little bit egregious.
Okay, Terry Stotts is also in that list. And you mentioned Budenholzer, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like Budenholzer. He faced a really tough year, so I wouldn't argue with putting him in that group. I would probably say both Terry Stotts and Scott Brooks should have been ranked a little bit higher based on what they did only really even in the past year. The Trailblazers finally figured out how to string together enough wins to get a good playoff seeding. Their playoff series against the Rockets was a lot of fun and had a classic ending to it. He's really put his young talent, Damian Lillard, paired with LaMarcus Aldridge, in a great spot to succeed. And so I like what he's done. And so, like Scott Brooks, he's figuring out how to really try to use his talent in the best way possible. And so I feel like both of those guys should have been ranked ahead of Hornacek and Clifford.
Well, you know what, though? I got to say this about Hornacek. He did get those kids to play. They were supposed to be tanking, and they didn't. I thought he did an exceptionally good job. In fact, that was who I kind of was hoping the Thunder would hire, is Jeff Hornacek, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly demonstrated that he knew the odds were stacked against him, so they had to try something radical. And they incorporated essentially a three-point guard offense, which is very difficult for teams to match up against, and they almost made the playoffs. Now, once they got into the playoffs, they probably would have gotten swept, because then it's all about matchups, and a good coach, even a mediocre coach with a good system, can game plan against those types of things. But I think the proof will be to see what they do this year, because now they actually have some expectations, and they can't just roll the ball out and just see what happens. And plus, they've got this whole Bledsoe situation. Who knows how that's going to end, too. So I like where they're going, but, you know, he hasn't really proven himself yet. He's had one good year where they had no expectations on them. So let's see what they do before we start saying that Hornacek is part of the upper echelon of coaches.
That's fair enough. And Budenholzer, too, then. I think that Budenholzer shouldn't be up in the upper echelon either. Even though they did make the playoffs, the East was pretty weak. And it is what it is. But some of the things that were said here, they say the knock on Brooks, or he says, the knock on Brooks is basically all X's and O's. The offense becomes general and rudimentary in clutch time. And then he goes on to say, the funny thing is, if the Thunder designed more complicated plays that resulted in someone else being open and shooting, Brooks would get killed for not getting Kevin Durant the ball. Now, technically, and I don't know how much Matt Moore pays attention to the Oklahoma City Thunder or the people who write about them every day, but that's kind of what they do kill him about, is the fact that they don't get Kevin Durant the ball enough at clutch time, right?
Yeah, and he actually couches the argument really well, in the sense that on the one hand, you've got the X's and O's not being executed. On the other hand, you've got, you know, Kevin Durant needs to have the ball, but he never really answers the question as to why there's this disparity. And we've done the studies, we've done the research at Welcome to Loud City, and we have a pretty good idea of why there's the disconnect. And that is, it's not an X's and O's thing, because the Thunder, their offensive sets are really not that different from anybody else's in the NBA. They all pretty much run the same things. What really separates a team from the Spurs and the Thunder is not the plays that they run, but the efficiency and the discipline and how they run it. And so we've looked at a lot of things, like how well the Thunder set screens in their offensive sets, how they operate in transition, how they create spacing to create passing lanes and shooting zones. And that's really the problem that they face. It's not the plays that they run. It's how they run them, how sloppy they can get, especially in crunch time, when you absolutely have to run a play the right way in order to get a guy open. Because now it's not Kevin Durant against, you know, some second string guy. It's Kevin Durant going against Kawhi Leonard, the best defensive wing in the NBA. And if you don't set the right screen at the right time, and use that screen effectively, he's going to bust through it and he's going to get a steal or he's going to block the shot. And so the lack of attention to those kinds of small details to me is what really separates the team. Kevin Durant is kind of notorious in my mind for running really sloppy screenplays. He doesn't use his screens well. He pulls his screeners out of position too far, so now that they're not part of the play either. And so if anything, I would say Scott Brooks and his staff need to focus on tightening up the plays that they already run so that they run them better. And I think once they do that, like the Spurs do, because the Spurs don't have guys who can go one-on-one a whole lot other than Tony Parker, once they do that, then they're going to see the kind of shooting zones that the Spurs have.
Yeah, that's pretty fair analysis, too, because it looks like a circus at the end. And that's because they got guys that just aren't effective at what Brooks attempts to try to do. So that, you know, maybe what they need to do is go out and find some players that can play the way Scott Brooks wants, and they'd be all set, kind of like the way the chief cook and bottle washer of the San Antonio Spurs, Greg Popovich, does. But then Brooks isn't in the same spot as Popovich. Brooks has to play with the hand that he's dealt. I don't know how much even he's involved in the decision-making process, to be honest. But that's a perfect segue into what we wanted to talk about a little bit. And that's this. One of the listeners wanted to know, what three things would you do to fix the Oklahoma City Thunder?
Well, I think number one is what I just stated. It's that they don't need to run better plays. They need to run plays better. And during the regular season, it's really easy to get away from the discipline of the fundamentals that you want to see, because the Thunder's offensive players are so good at creating separation, whether it's Durant, Westbrook, or even Reggie Jackson. Those guys can create shots for themselves so easily against the bottom tier of the NBA that I don't think they put enough focus and attention on the little things like setting a good screen, setting up the screener properly, creating a good, clean passing zone so that the ball doesn't get stolen. I think if they dedicate themselves to focusing on those kinds of things from training camp onward, then by the time April and May roll around, they're going to find themselves in a position like the Spurs did, where they were rolling over really good teams, whether it was the Thunder, whether it was the Blazers, or whether it was the practical sweep in the finals. They were so good at creating open looks for anybody that they shot at a ridiculous percentage in the finals. And that is established during the course of the season. So I want to see the Thunder focus on that, number one. Number two, I want to see them be better at utilizing their full resources. A lot of people have been down on the Thunder this offseason because they didn't really do a whole lot. They only acquired one player of substance in Anthony Morrow. And they jettisoned Derek Fisher retired. They got rid of Caron Butler. Thabo Sefolosha is in Atlanta now. So people feel like, oh, they got rid of some key components. Well, yeah, they did, but I really feel like they got better by getting rid of those guys. But now the challenge is you got to trust these younger guys that they're going to be better in April and May than they are in October and November. And that means that you have to be willing to go through all the bumps that a regular season is going to hold in order to get those guys ready. And so I would like to see Scott Brooks and his staff say, we need these supplemental guys. We need Morrow. We need Jackson. We need Mitch McGarry, Stephen Adams. We need those guys to be good by the time spring rolls around. So we're going to put the work in now, and we're going to take our lumps now in order to get them there. So definitely dedication and balance in their overall team makeup. And then lastly, I would say just continued improvement by their big three, Durant, Ibaka, and Westbrook. Played again. It'll be great to see Westbrook play for a full season again with his two All-Star level teammates. I think Ibaka definitely has earned a spot in the All-Star discussion. And then just let them build some chemistry that they did not have last year, because Westbrook was in, then he was out, then he was in again, and it was a little rocky. So I want to see them build some chemistry. And so utilizing the levels 1 and 2 that I just mentioned, let's see what they can do at the end of it.
Those are good answers. You know, I'll do mine in a minute. How's that? Because I have a minute left. The first thing that I would do to fix the Thunder is basically what you said. Execute in the last 2 minutes of the game. Work on that execution because they're horrendous in big games in the last 2 minutes of the game. The catch and chuck brothers, it's got to be more than that. The second thing that I would do is I would start Jeremy Lamb at the small forward, and I'm going to tell you why. Because I would re-sign Reggie Jackson. I'd make sure I did that. And I would start him at the point, put Russell Westbrook off on the number two, run a smaller lineup and watch these young kids fly down the court. I like to watch that. It'd be fun to see, and this would take a lot of the X's and O pressure off Scott Brooks because we all know that he's incapable of X's and O's. J.A., great stuff today, man. Thanks for being on the show. All right, that was J.A. Sherman. You can find him over at welcometoloudcity.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
Hi, we're Rob Folkett, and you're listening to Phil Nason Show.
Father John, I'm in love with your daughter. What a one with a champagne.
Riveting talk radio.
Everybody get up.
People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
no.
I think, and it probably comes from porn as well.
You yeah.
I mean, that's got to
sure.
be a big, strong big, thing. Strong
oh, that's
thing.
Gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Talk radio. Bend over, baby.
That was great.
Central Portugal's only English-speaking information station. This is Epix Radio. Listen online, www.epixradio.com.
If you like baseball, you should be checking out baseballpodcasts.net. It's one of the best places you can go on the internet to listen to independent baseball talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our radio player that can be heard around the world. So won't you tune in and give us a listen at baseballpodcasts.net. You can also listen to the great Phil Nason show here. See you there at baseballpodcast.net.
Brewtown Sports is your source for Brewers news and notes. Join Mr. Brewtown as he keeps you up to date on all the happenings of your Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball. Follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, Brewtown Sports. Listen 24/7 at brewtownsports.podomatic.com.
Hi, this is Phil Nason from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nason Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
And now,
shut the hell up.
Back to the Phil Nason Show.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. The Miami Heat, the basketball season is about to start in one more week. Matt Moore, we talked about this in the first segment. Matt Moore from CBS, he wrote a blog post, article, is a biggie, and where he ranked the coaches. And this segment, we're going to talk Miami Heat basketball with Hot Hot Hoops lead writer, David Ramil. He's on the phone. Ramil, how you doing, man?
Doing very good. Looking forward to the season. I'm like a junkie in need of a fix, and I am waiting for NBA basketball to mean something again.
Yeah, to mean something again. I think you're right. The fun thing about basketball, though, David, is that there's always something happening, even in the off season. It's not like baseball where you have that free agent signing period that lasts about a week, and then you have nothing really, and you just have to kind of create things. But basketball, there's always something. And this Matt Moore NBA coaching rankings, he says our ratings for every NBA coach was interesting. Now, this is what I'm good. Eric Spoelstra, the Miami Heat coach, as you know, was ranked number 4. Now, above him was the obvious choice, Greg Popovich, Rick Carlisle, number 2, Doc Rivers, number 3, Eric Spoelstra, number 4, Tom Thibodeau, number 5. That's who he would consider the creme de la creme, the top of the heap, so to speak. Legitimate coach of the year preseason candidates, considered best coaches in NBA. That's the subtitle behind this, David. And this is what he had to say about Eric Spoelstra. I'll read a little bit of it, and then you can chime in. This one is sure to rankle some folks. Yep, it will. Spoelstra caught a lot of the runoff flack for the Heat, and now the best player on earth is headed back to Miami. Many will expect the Heat to tumble. Mr. Moore, he headed back to Cleveland. That's okay. We'll straighten it out. Listen to our show on Monday. If they do, you can expect Spoelstra's ranking to fall as well. Do you honestly think that this ranking has anything to do? Okay, maybe LeBron had something to do with it. But don't you think, and I'm one of these guys, and like I've always been a Heat hater, but I'm also not someone who's stupid enough to miss, the forest from the trees. Eric Spoelstra's done a fine job with that Heat team, whether LeBron was on it or not. Do you think that he's going to tumble in the rankings and people are going to look down on him if they don't do what they were doing for the last 4 years?
I think when it comes to basketball in particular, there's always this recency bias where what have you done for me lately defines the narrative. And I think that people will be quick to credit that Spoelstra's success has been based on the last 4 years rather than looking at the previous two where he led a very weak team to the playoffs, that had Wade and a bunch of castoffs, including Udonis Haslam. So I think they won't match the success of this season. They might be able to sneak into the Eastern Conference Finals. I don't see them advancing to the NBA Finals, not realistically. But I don't see them matching that same level of success as the last 4 years. But it'll still have been a supreme job, if nothing else, for having integrated the new pieces in the Heat lineup, for maximizing the most of what they could possibly do. So this might be his greatest challenge as a coach ever, and I think it's one he'll meet. If people have those unrealistic expectations of championship or bust, they're going to be disappointed, and that's what will make his standing tumble down a little bit. But I think he's a great coach. I don't think he gets enough credit for what he did previous to LeBron in the Big Three era. And I think that people tend to look at what he's done based on LeBron's abilities, Chris Bosh being on the roster. But, integrating those three alpha males was a huge challenge, and he did a great job. He really did. I know there was some stress there in the early season of 2010, but he handled it great. He's really become the face of the franchise. He's been given all the all the room in the world by Pat Riley to kind of make his own statement, define Heat culture in his own way, and he's done an excellent job.
That's a very good response, and I honestly think that this basketball team that he has now is probably better than the one he took to the playoffs in 2009. I think that he's a lot better coach than he was then, right?
Absolutely. The team is much, much better. I really expect some great things from Luol Deng. He's, the more I watch him, and I've seen a lot of, highlight film of him lately, he's athletic. He battled injuries, but, the grind in Chicago, and this is the knock on Thibodeau that everybody knows about, is that he kills his players. He overworks them, and there's no way they respond favorably. That's why they've all had the injury problems that they have, with the exception of Joakim Noah. So, he's probably due for injury at some point this season. But anyway, I think, Spoelstra's done a great job, and they're going to be a really, really good team this year. I think there's a lot of versatility from a lot of different players. There's some youth on here that hasn't been present over the last 4 years when they were just, adding veteran pieces to kind of supplement and complement what the big three were able to do. So he's got some really nice pieces, and I'm expecting big things out of the team.
And you should, I think, because I think this is a much more versatile team than it was with during the LeBron James era. It might even be a better team. They might not get the same results, but
right.
This is going to be a pretty interesting thing. And then Moore goes on to say, but in the meantime, Spoelstra's system provides one of the best defensive alignments you're going to find. And he finds ways to maximize what his team does.
Right.
He gets guys to buy in and is meticulous to the point of obsession about his preparation. So that's really nice that he couched that into the other part. I don't know how this thing rankles anyone, really. I guess it probably would. But if you put him ahead of Doc, or don't put him ahead of Doc Rivers, I think that something's wrong. Because Eric Spoelstra is a better basketball coach than Doc Rivers is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. It's hard to gauge because Rivers did what he could in Boston. I mean, he led them to a championship there, but he wasn't successful prior to that when he was with Orlando. He didn't really achieve much success there, and he really hasn't gotten the most out of a Clippers team that was expected to contend. Now everybody says, well, it's the Western Conference. What are you going to do? But he still had a really talented team. He had some injury issues with Chris Paul, et cetera, but I mean, he could have done a better job out there, and I think to have him ranked above Spoelstra is a disservice to Coach Spoelstra. So I think that it's hard to say because so many people think that Spoelstra's success was based on the big three. But I mean, look at Del Harris in the Lakers when he had Kobe and Shaq, he wasn't able to get anything out of them. And then Phil Jackson comes in there and leads them to a championship the following season. So, I mean, it's not an automatic given that just because you have a talented roster or you have superstars on your team that you're going to get a ring. And we're going to look to Cleveland to see what, David Blatt is able to do. This is a guy with no NBA experience, and now all of a sudden he's going to deal with the biggest media circus probably in NBA history, maybe even exceed what the Heat went through in 2010. How is he going to get those young, unproven pieces? Kyrie Irving, yeah, he's a star. Yeah, he was an all-star, and he's a solid player. But how is he going to respond to not having the ball as much as he has over the last few seasons when LeBron dominates every aspect of the team? And how this coach responds is going to be a huge question for what they can do this season.
That's exactly correct, too. And you know what? Doc Rivers didn't have that successful of a career even in Boston.
You're right.
They were a lottery team damn near. So until they pulled the trigger and brought in Ray Allen and Kevin Garnett.
Right.
And let's not also forget that their defense, where Doc Rivers is considered this defensive guru,
that was a bunch of
hogwash.
Yeah.
Eric Spoelstra deserves to be number three on this list. And I tell you what, Tom Thibodeau should be ahead of Doc Rivers as well. I like Doc Rivers as a player. I like him as a coach, but I don't think that he belongs at number three unless someone's trying to fish for an interview or something. There's no freaking way. I mean, you can't put Doc Rivers ahead of a guy like Eric Spoelstra. I don't care how many LeBron James you have. He still got his team to the finals 4 years in a row. I don't think that Doc Rivers could do something like that at gunpoint. I mean, so let's just call it what it is. This is silly.
So I didn't hear your previous segment, but who's your top three then? You've got Popovich, I assume, at the top. You got Carlisle up there as well, or you have Thibodeau in his stead?
I have Pop. We only talked about how it relates to Scott Brooks, but if you ask me the top three coaches in the NBA, Greg Popovich, Rick Carlisle, and Thibodeau.
Okay.
And I would put Spoelstra at number four.
So pretty much the same place, but you kind of flip-flop Thibodeau for
Yeah, and you know why? Because Thibodeau, he's had to really deal with some major crap. He's lost his MVP, the MVP of the league 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And he's still got those guys to hum and bum, and they play such bone-crushing defense. I love watching them play defense. They just were a little bit offensively challenged without Derrick Rose. I mean, and you can't really blame them, but they don't quit. That's a basketball team that doesn't quit, and that's a credit to their coach, I think. I really believe that Thibodeau, I think if Thibodeau had a team like maybe Eric Spoelstra's, they might have won all four.
Well, we're going to see if he has another side to him this year when he has a guy like, Pau Gasol that can do a lot and is versatile in his own way and can facilitate a lot of the offense. So If Rose comes back, and I don't think anybody expects him to be at the MVP level he was three seasons ago, but if he can, you know, kind of match some of his, you know, the way his speed and athleticism were demonstrated in the FIBA World Cup tournament, I think that they'll probably be a pretty solid team. I mean, I think a lot of experts have them probably as being the top team in the Eastern Conference, although I don't know a lot of people who expect him to advance all the way to the finals. So we'll see what he can get out of this team, not just defensively, but I guess offensively is the biggest question.
I have Chicago going to the finals.
All right.
I really do. Even though I'm living in Akron, I'm not afraid of these guys. I'll tell you what, though. It's going to be a circus. You called that right when LeBron comes, you know, when they start. When I come down here to the library to do the show, there's a big sign on the overpass that says, "Welcome home, LeBron."
Ridiculous.
It's still there. Well, they're pretty excited. But, you know, and if you put Spoelstra ahead of Thibodeau, that's fine with me. I mean, they're right there and I connect. But Doc Rivers, I don't even know if he belongs in that conversation, to be honest with you. When you and then the other ones, Steve Clifford, he doesn't belong in the conversation. Jeff Hornacek doesn't belong in that conversation. I'll tell you who could win Coach of the Year, though, David. If Frank Vogel at Indiana, if those guys go, if they make the playoffs and win the first round, he'll be the Coach of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, if he can get anything out of C.J. Miles and Rodney Stuckey, and if he can save what's left of Roy Hibbert's fragile psyche, I think that definitely merits Coach of the Year consideration, to say the least. I mean, just getting into the playoffs, a lot of people want to, you know, talk about the Eastern Conference being as weak as it is, but I mean, getting a playoff spot with that team as it's currently built, unless they make a huge midseason acquisition or something like that, I mean, that's a team desperate for anything at this point. I mean, they don't have much. They'll probably have a pretty solid defense with Hibbert blocking the rim, but well, I mean, they don't have anything else going for them at this point. I mean, they could tumble to a lottery team, and I wouldn't think anybody would put it past them to do so. But if he's able to make the playoffs, yeah, Coach of the Year for sure, to say the least.
Well, exactly. You know, the other curiosity, because we only got a couple minutes, we won't have time to do what we were going to do. But this is fine. What Stan Van Gundy, that should be interesting because he's a former Heat coach. I would have put if we we'll do this some other time, and I'll mention him again, but Stan Van Gundy might do a good job with Detroit. I don't know how he's going to get Josh Smith and those other two big fellas to coexist. That ought to be interesting, too.
Well, I've written about it before, and I kind of see Andre Drummond having a quote-unquote breakout season because I think Van Gundy can get the most out of his big man. He was, you know, part of Riley's staff in New York, and he helped Ewing. He was here in Miami during the Alonzo Mourning era, so I think given a chance, he's going to be able to really maximize some great talent there from a fairly young player. I don't know if he's going to go MVP level. I mean, maybe all-star level just because there's such a lack of quality big men. But I think that he's going to be able to do a pretty solid job. Now, the question mark for me there is Greg Monroe in a contract year. He'll be an unrestricted free agent next season. He's going to want to get his points, his stats up so that he can get himself some money next offseason. So is he going to undermine everything Van Gundy can do with Drummond, considering the fact that Monroe is probably on his way out regardless? So, I mean, that's going to be a huge question mark. That's going to be the sword of Damocles hanging over their head for the rest of the season. And, you know, you've got Josh Smith there, a noted head case. Brandon Jennings isn't any more stable this season than he was last. There's a lot of issues there, so this is going to be Van Gundy's greatest challenge also. You know, he had a solid team in Orlando, got them all the way to the finals. He did a great job here in Miami with Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade. So, I mean, he's got the proven chops, but we'll see what he can do with his Detroit lineup that has so many glaring holes in it.
You know that's right, but the thing is there might not be such big holes. And here's the thing. You know what's going to happen. He's going to clean house.
Yeah.
And this year probably is a gimme year for Detroit. If wherever they get, they'll take the gimme. But I don't think that they're going to go too far. And I don't think that the ownership cares that much this season because Van Gundy doesn't have his guys. He's going to do things. You're right with Drummond. You know, Terry Stotts, the Portland Trailblazers coach, he was tied for 10th on this list. You know, I guess at some point it's pretty hard to put them anywhere, but they placed him ahead of a couple of coaches here, Lionel Hollins. Some of these guys don't belong. I don't know the reasoning behind it. I guess it doesn't really matter, but Spoelstra, are you excited about this season? Because it's going to be challenging without LeBron, right? But you're excited, right?
You mean as far from the Heat perspective? Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's... I think so many people were kind of, from a Heat fan perspective, I've seen so many of their fans kind of just, you know, the expectations of the last four seasons that they were just going to automatically cruise into the finals or maybe get a challenge from, say, an Indiana or a Brooklyn team in the playoffs. I think they kind of just like were on autopilot for 82 games. But this is the real, I think, the first chance in a long time to kind of enjoy this team on a day-to-day basis, because they're going to be hardworking. I think they're going to be very versatile. They're going to be a lot of fun to watch. They're not going to be as great. And that's the thing that LeBron provides, in that, you know, there were so many moments there over the last 4 years when this team was down, you know, 10, 15 points. And in a matter of seconds, they could turn that around, that deficit into a lead. So there's going to be, you know, it's going to be a great thing to watch from a fan's perspective, although the end result, like we talked about, may not be as great as it has been over the last 4 years.
All right, great stuff today. Thanks for being on the show, David.
You got it, Phil.
All right, that was David Ramil. You can find him at hothoothoops.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
Hi, we're Ron Forget, and you're listening to Phil Nason Show.
Riveting talk radio.
Everybody get up.
People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
no.
I think, and it probably comes from porn as well.
You know what
I mean? That's got to be a big, strong thing.
Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Dog radio. Bend over, baby. That was great.
Central Portugal's only English-speaking information station. This is Epics Radio. Listen online, www.epicsradio.com.
If you like baseball, you should be checking out baseballpodcasts.net. It's one of the best places you can go on the internet to listen to independent baseball talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our radio player that can be heard around the world. So won't you tune in and give us a listen at baseballpodcasts.net. You can also listen to the great Phil Nason show here. See you there at baseballpodcast.net.
Brewtown Sports is your source for Brewers news and notes. Join Mr. Brewtown as he keeps you up to date on all the happenings of your Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball. Follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, Brewtown Sports. Listen 24/7 at brewtownsports.podomatic.com.
Hi, this is Phil Nasons from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nasons Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
And now,
shut the hell up.
Back to the Phil Nason Show.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. We're wrapping up an amazing day of NBA and Major League Baseball talk. We've been following the Oakland A's week in and week out for the last three seasons now. And joining me to talk about this wild card that they shouldn't even be in, please welcome from AthleticsNation.com, Alex Hall is in the house. Alex, what's up, man? How are you?
Six games left in the season. What's going to happen?
What's going to happen is the Oakland A's are going to win a wild card. That's what's going to happen.
I hope so, and it's looking that way. But, you know, they've shown recently that there's no guarantee of anything. But six games left with three games over the Mariners, that feels fairly safe.
I would think so, yeah. And you know, the funny thing is with Seattle, they have two more with Toronto, who gave King Felix a beatdown yesterday, and the three with the Angels. It's a done deal, brother.
Well, nothing's a done deal because
A's fans are loving me these days.
They can drop six in a row to finish a season and just shock everybody. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm just saying that's definitely the kind of physical possibility that we've seen in the second half. But yeah, it's got to be like a 95% certainty at this point. It would take getting swept by the Rangers again, basically.
You know what it will take? Yeah, like, yeah, that's exactly right. It would take exactly what the A's did two seasons ago to the Texas Rangers to come from behind and win the division.
There you go. You got to remember history like that or you're doomed to repeat it, right? So I don't want to get too cocky about something being tied up, you know, with six games left, having done that to another team just a couple years ago.
You know what? I agree with you, too. I agree with that. But I've been trumping there. I've been blowing the trumpet for the A's all year. I've been on the bandwagon. I want to see them play the Tigers because that'll be fun for us. It's amazing. I'm a Tiger fan. I write at an Oakland A's site. But
you know, that's interesting you say that, because I was just thinking last night, you know, the Royals and the Tigers are still so close in the standings. I mean, they're like within a game of each other, I think. So, you know, the A's can be pretty confident they're getting in. They're not going to win their division, and it's a slim chance that the Mariners have time to pass them. But between Tigers, Royals, we don't know which one of them might finish in first place and which one will be facing us in the wild card game. And I kind of wonder, who would you rather face in which? Of course, you'd rather face the Royals in general, just because they seem less scary and there's no Miguel Cabrera there. But then I wonder, you know, if you get the Royals in the one-game play-in, you get James Shields, I would imagine. I mean, I looked at their rotation, and it looks like it's set up so that Shields would be in that. And, you know, big game James, you know, I don't know if you want to really face him. It's better than facing Felix, but it's still a daunting task. But then, you know, the rest of their rotation, good, but not at the same level. But then I think, you know, if you want to go up against the Tigers in a five-game series, you're going to have to face Scherzer and you're going to have to face Price. And I know Verlander's having an off year, but you find me one A's fan who wants to face him once or twice in another five-game series for the third straight year. So I almost wonder, is it better to face the Tigers in the one-game series, only have to deal with one of their pitchers? You're going to have to beat a good pitcher in that one-game series no matter what. And then if you can make it through that, then your reward is you get the longer five-game series against the Royals, where you get to maybe have more of their weaknesses exposed instead of just having all of their strengths in one game, you know, James Shields plus that back end of that bullpen. If you get them in five games instead, maybe you get to pick at a couple of weaker spots on the team instead.
The Tigers bullpen's weak.
Tigers bullpen's weak and the Royals bullpen is strong. So there you go. Yeah. Maybe that's a reason to see Detroit. Of course, I'm getting cocky here trying to pick which team I see where in the playoffs. You know, again, as an A's fan, I'm just going to be thrilled now to get there, which is a disappointing thing to think.
It's not the conversation we had all season.
Right, yeah. So I don't want to now sound like overly cocky trying to pick and choose who I prefer to play in the playoffs, but it's a natural thought. And I almost wonder if it would be better to play Detroit in the one game, get them out of the way, if that's even possible, and then maybe see the Royals in five. Anyone really want to try the Tigers in five again? I don't need to see that again.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that would be the better alternative. You know, Kansas City Royals, when they have the lead after the seventh inning, they've won like 85% of their games, 90% of their games. And those kids come in there and close the door. And that's a tough one. With the Tigers, you don't know what you're going to get. They're like, in a lot of ways, Alex, I think they're like the A's. They're teams that were expected to run away with their divisions and then just didn't. Had struggles and slumps, big, you know, you've got this team of big stars, and I guess now you got a few in Oakland, but one of the conversations that's come up, and I thought we would get into that a little bit, is Scott Kazmir, who's pitched really well all season, is struggling. He's struggled his last five games. We'll get into that too, but there's the conversation of who do you start on Friday against Texas in order to prepare the rotation for the playoffs. And folks are starting to talk, maybe not starting Scott Kazmir, but perhaps Drew Pomeranz, or even, and I can't believe I'm saying this because 6 weeks ago they were ready to hang him out and off the San Francisco pier, is Jason Hamill. What do you think of that conversation? Is it's a good conversation to have, right?
Well, it's almost a necessary conversation now, and the reason we're having it is on July 27th, Kazmir had a 2.37 ERA. And of course, that kind of performance got him into the All-Star game this year. So he was doing quite well. Since then, he's made 10 starts. So this is basically August and September. He's made 10 starts. He's a 6.67 ERA. He's only thrown 54 innings overall. So he's only averaging about 5 innings per start. And that's because he gets lit up so often that you know, 1, 2, 3 times he's failed to even make it out of the fifth. So he's kind of had a rough go of it there. If you cut that down to just his last 6 starts, that ERA is 8.58. He's only gone 28 innings in those 6 games. That's under 5 innings per start. So something's gone wrong. I'm not sure. I think that velocity is down a bit. He might just be getting worn out. You know, he only threw 150 innings last year. And, you know, he's getting that number a little bit higher this year. But this is the tough choice. You know, he's at 183 innings now. If he makes another start, he'll be at, you know, 190 or so. Do you go with the guy who got you here all year? Or do you look and say, hey, it's not like he just had 2 bad starts heading into the playoffs. He had 2 bad months heading into the playoffs. And not just that. He's had at least 2 of those poor starts against the very team you would be probably playing in the ALDS, and that's the Angels. I know we've had that discussion about the Tigers Royals. That would be probably more likely who you would see maybe in the ALCS. In the ALDS, it's going to be the Angels because they're going to have the best record. They're going to play the wild card. So if the A's make that series, do you start Kazmir against the Angels after he got absolutely rocked by them? And I have those 2 starts right here. Like, one of them, he didn't even make it out of the second inning. It was a total of 4.1 innings and 13 runs over 2 starts against the Angels. I don't know if you can start that guy in the playoffs. And remember, last year they were down to make a snap decision when Sonny Gray did that complete game shutout against the Tigers. When Game 5 rolled around, they bypassed Bartolo Colon, the guy who got Cy Young votes, to go with that hot hand Sonny. And that makes me wonder, are they willing to do that again the other way? And that is not just a guy is so hot you have to pitch him, but a guy is so cold that you have to skip him. So now, who do you have? As you say, Pomeranz and Hamill. Well, you've got Pomeranz, intriguing choice. When you pitch him, you're hoping for a smaller concentration of really good innings. He's got this knack for going out and throwing exactly 5 shutout innings in a start. Out of his 10 or so starts that he's made this year, he's done that 4 times. But he's unlikely to go 6 or 7 innings. They don't have his pitch count that high. He hasn't been starting consistently all year. He hasn't been consistently stretched out. So he often only goes 80 or 90 pitches. So you're not going to get a 7 or 8 inning gem out of him. But I mean, there's some guys in the bullpen. You know, you get in the playoffs, 5 shutout innings is pretty valuable. So that could be worth it. He did just get a start against the Phillies recently. And again, 5 shutout innings. So he's a possibility. Jason Hamill, he had those 4 terrible starts to start his career here. And everyone just was ready to write him off right then. It seemed a little premature. He'd been so good all season, and then he just suddenly had 4 bad starts for no reason. Well, turns out there were some mechanics issues that he worked out, and over his 7 starts since, his ERA is 2.81. He's thrown 41 innings. He's always averaging 6 innings per start. His strikeouts are mostly back. The walks are back down. He's still given up a lot of home runs, but again, 2.81 ERA over 7 starts. this is no longer the weak link in the rotation. This guy is pitching very well, and you have to consider if he should be part of a playoff rotation. And what you end up having to pick between is that young guy who you have a whole lot of faith in, but you haven't seen him do it super consistently yet. And then you've got this veteran Hamill who has maybe a history closer to mediocrity, but a more recent stretch of being actually very good. You know, the sub-3 ERA with the Cubs and now the sub-3 ERA in these 7 starts with the A's. I got to say, I kind of feel like you have to go with Hamill at this point, at least in the last start of the season, of the regular season. I got to see what Hamill's got.
You know, that's pretty good stuff. I'll tell you what, Kazmir, though, I watched him play against Philadelphia. He threw his slider a lot. And then I looked it up today, and he threw, or at least I thought he was, and I couldn't believe it. He threw his slider 26% of the time in that baseball game. Prior to that, Alex, he hadn't gone over 15% since June the 14th against the Yankees. That's not good because he's a fastball pitcher. That slider is supposed to be something a little extra, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
And his fastball, his percentage of fastball was 52%. That's not good either. He's got to get that. When he was hot, he was throwing it at, like against the Mets, he threw it at 64% one night. 58, 57, not 52. And he went, and he's gone with that changeup a bit more lately too. I think he's lost confidence in his fastball. He hasn't lost any velocity, but what he has lost is some confidence with it. He might be tired too. But I'm one of those guys, Alex, that, you know, you dance with the girl you brought. And I think Kazmir deserves to start on Friday to see if he can shake it. If he can get it done on Friday, then you have to go with him. I don't trust Pomerantz. He doesn't pitch enough innings, for goodness sakes. And Hamill? Hamill's Jason Hamill. He's pitched good the last 7 games, but then he can go into one of those funks. I don't know, man. I think I have to take Kazmir. I hate to disagree with you, but I have to take Kazmir.
I will say with the velocity, that four-seam fastball velocity, according to Brooks Baseball here, that was at around 93 miles an hour during the heat of the summer when he was at his best. It's down to 91 now. So it seems he has lost a little bit of his velocity, and I wonder if that could explain what you were saying about why he goes for the slider more. If that fastball velocity is down, you know, 2 miles an hour is quite a bit. It's going to mean the pitch isn't working quite like he wants it to. Maybe that could be a reason he's not leaning on it as much. But yeah, at this point, you've got that one more regular season turn through the rotation to take one more look at a guy, and then it's going to be that moment of truth, and you're going to have to decide. And there's a good chance that with Lester going in that wild card game, whoever wins this spot is going to be pitching maybe game 2 or game 3 of an ALDS.
That's entirely possible. Really, it is. But geez, we talked about this last week. We've got about 45 seconds, Alex. It's hard to believe that the Oakland Athletics are fighting for a wild card, even though they're up 3 games over Seattle. This doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. But it's been a good season anyway. I'm really looking forward to the playoffs, looking forward to that wild card, looking forward to this weekend series with the Texas Rangers. Alex, great stuff today. Thanks for being on the show with me.
Hey, thanks a lot, Phil.
All right, that was Alex Hall. You can find him over at athleticsnation.com, and that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. I want to thank all the guys for making this a lot of fun to do today. We're going to do it all again tomorrow, same kind of way. Until then, y'all take care of yourselves. Be good, and most importantly,
ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you.